Welcome to Understanding Irish Muslims. In this episode, we talk to Irish Muslims who are involved in the so-called Arab Spring and others involved in conflict in previous decades. I also spoke to expert analysts, Dr. Vincent Jurek and Mary Fitzgerald, about the underlying reasons behind the Arab Spring. And I met with the Al-Sayed family, who tragically lost their son Hudaifa in Syria. The Al-Sayed family live in Mornington, just outside Drogheda. Their son and brother Hudaifa joined the Syrian rebels to fight the Assad regime, although, as his family explained, he originally volunteered to work with Syrian refugees. But first they talk about the revolution in their native Egypt in the spring of 2011 against the rule of President Mubarak.
It went worse in the last 30 years when Mubarak came. And there were many trials to change the country slowly to good or have some even democracy, gradual democracy. If you want to live without trouble, don't do anything, don't think, don't talk.
I asked Hudaifa's sister Samaya what triggered the revolution in Egypt.
It sort of just needed a smaller trigger. It was years and years of build-up of oppression and then just one more trigger. And then what happened in Tunis kind of made people wake up as well. And like, you know, we don't want to live like this anymore either. Over the internet, people were protesting. And then they set a date, okay, let's go out in the actual protest outside. Mm. And like my dad said, they didn't expect a huge number, but they realized that, yes, everybody is fed up. Mm. So it's not like when they started off, I don't think they had planned that we want Mubarak out and we want a whole new country. Yeah. I don't think they had all this in their mind when it started. They wanted change.
Sam Najjar, born in Dublin, to an Irish mother and Libyan father, was one of many Irish men who took part in the Libyan revolution. He gives us a sample of what life was like for Muslims under Gaddafi.
Gaddafi was posted on every billboard, on every wall. He's in people's minds, he's in people's hearts. He's like that propaganda machine was on full power. I'll give you an example, the breaking of Ramadan, the breaking of fast in Ramadan, where here people gather around the family atmosphere and have that first meal of the day. And Libyan TV at that time and moment, he would show videos of his opponents being hung.
Dr. Vincent Jurek, lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations at University College Dublin, explains the underlying causes of the Arab Spring.
I would suggest that the starting point for a lot of this is socioeconomic. Mm. So not necessarily about democracy, for instance. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that, or not necessarily about liberal democracy as we tend to understand it, about having input, about being able to have a say, mm-hmm. about a more just, in the broadest sense, a more equitable society in which, you know, people who work hard would have a chance to get on.
We return to the Al-Sayed family in Drogheda, where Dr. Abdel Basset Al-Sayed tells us about three of the main reasons behind the Egyptian revolution.
There are three things raised in the revolution from the first. Harriya, Aish Harriya Adal Ektimai. Aish means to get a good life, good economical life. Harriya, freedom, and justice.
In a way, the violence that the government faced them with didn't turn them back. If anything, it gave them more strength. We can't take this anymore.
Dr. Fatima Hamrouche was appointed Libya's first ever female minister for health under the post-Gaddafi National Transitional Council. She told me about the role she played in revealing to the world her experience of life under Gaddafi.
Before the Arab Spring, I was in the Libyan opposition. I was known among the opposition members and I was quite active in many aspects, really. Most people didn't know that. Even my closest friends in Ireland didn't know much about this because of the fear for safety, really, not for anything. And it's not something that you would trust anyone about. In fact, even now after the revolution, we discovered so many people we thought they are with us and unlike us. They turned to be really spies and stuff like that. It was amazing.
Really? Yeah, yeah. Within the Libyan movement.
But then when the revolution came, I shared in supporting the revolution. Even before the revolution, not just myself, of course, with the other people in the opposition, we were working hard to show the world about the atrocities of the government, and we succeeded.
Mary Fitzgerald, Foreign Affairs correspondent with the Irish Times, told me how the revolutions led to a political engagement of young Irish Arabs.
What it basically has triggered here in Ireland is amongst the Arab community here, it has triggered something close to a political awakening, in that particularly amongst young Irish of Arab extraction whose parents were born in some of the countries where that have experienced revolutions and uprisings, or they themselves have been born in those countries. They have become politically engaged now in the uprisings, in the revolutions, or in the societies that are in transition in Tunisia, Egypt and Libya.
Sam tells us about how he kept up to date with what was happening in Libya and what his initial hopes were.
I watched February 17th, the Day of Anger, kick off, and for weeks on end be in front of the TV screen, falling asleep with the remote in my hand, waking up with that remote still in my hand, on edge for every last bit of information, what was happening, hoping that it would, the revolution would either flourish, or that, you know, that either way, once the country was in war torn, and that there was a bloodshed saved.
Dr. Hamroush tells us about the dangers of being involved in the anti-Gaddafi movement and our humanitarian work.
It's dangerous to be in the Libyan opposition. There is no Libyan opposition that's recognized by the government. We are considered as criminals.
Right.
And I was using a nickname. I wasn't using my real name. Actually, from the day of the revolution, I announced my real name and I mentioned that this is me. That's the nickname is me. This person is me. And I noticed some people used to ring me and talk to me, they completely cut off.
Really?
Because at that time nothing was certain. The revolution could have failed.
Yes.
And I would have been executed.
Sam talked to me about the role his mother played in his taking part in the revolution in Libya.
So I was hearing phone calls from my mom. She was saying, you know, your brother-in-law is there, your brother's after going over. And I'd be like, you know, I'm caught up in everything, it's not that easy. And she's not that she was pushing me, but she was wondering, she found it strange because my other brother, she knew I had a lot to give and that I'd have that kind of potential that I'd be able to offer something. So when we heard the stories of the rape coming out, that was, I knew that I just said, I have to do something, like, and I knew that I could. I knew that my brother-in-law was there in the Western Mountains at this stage. He had moved from the Eastern Front to a new Western Front had begun. Tripoli was always in my heart, so the thought of Tripoli being liberated was always something that I dreamt of, like, you know, to think, like, to go to walk into the capital as a free man, or to liberate that country, or to liberate the capitalists, to liberate the country, like, you know. So, yeah, I trained physically, mentally, 24 hours a day, nearly every day. I got about 2-3 hours sleep for weeks on end. I got ill at times from the lack of sleep. I was driving late night routes, doing arms deals and working with covert operatives and doing all kinds of stuff with one eye open and one eye closed, looking at the signpost on the side of the road saying, if you feel tired, park up for a little while. And I'd be just laughing, going, oh, you know, I've gone well past that. I'm resting one eye and then for a few minutes and then using the other. You know, it's just, that's how harsh it was. We had a few battles in the Western Mountains. They were in mountainous terrain. It was a different kind of a battlefield. It was a battlefield that was good for me to learn on, because I was able to gauge my courage, as in to say, you know, behind you is safe, you know your enemy is in front of you, so how much you move forward is how much courage you have. In urban warfare, you can't really do that, because if you move too far ahead, you could get sniped from behind, you could get all kinds of stuff.
Own Yahya Whelan told me about his frontline experience in Libya and how the simple things done wrong could be fatal.
It's difficult to get, you know, specific weapon cleaning fluids in the desert.
Yeah.
What you can use is ammonia. So a window cleaner has high concentrations of ammonia. So people generally use window cleaner. And so I said, oh, I said, did you have window cleaner or something? And he said, no, I don't have. And so I was going, what do you use? Like, then what? Don't tell me like soap or something, you know, you don't use it. He's like, no, I don't. And that was the scariest thing honestly, that I'd ever experienced in my life. Because like these are the rounds that they're using, they're surplus rounds, they're army surplus rounds. They've been sitting in a crate in some damp underground storage facility for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
If you have these damp rounds, when they fire, not all the gunpowder burns off, and it's really corrosive. So it sticks to the edge of the barrel. What can happen is if that rust builds up enough and you're firing away, the heat can make it expand and it will jam and it'll explode in your hand. And that's scary. Because he's firing this weapon beside my head. And so is his mate.
Sam told me about the risks he had to take to get arms to his colleagues.
It was a matter of getting every man in our barracks armed and able to protect himself. Now, I know, say for example, with the arms, it was because of your comrades. You know, you have comrades in the base there with no arms. You know he's there, you know he wants to fight, he's a good man, he's this and that and the other. Yet if the enemy climbed over the mountain the next day, like, you know, what are you going to do, give him your own gun? You know,
right.
So you had to, they were your comrades and you had to arm them. Same again with, you know, operatives from America, from NATO, stuff like that. That's what I'm saying, it's a very multifaceted mission, you know. There was a lot involved, a lot of stuff that I picked up very quick. You're talking about giving them strategic locations of mercenaries that had gone underground in Tripoli, that had moved their arsenals in under buildings because they knew that NATO was starting its campaign. And so, or even attacks, sometimes they were ready to attack our base.
We'd so they'd give you, you'd give information to them,
they'd take them out. Yeah. And so, like, even rubbing shoulders with soldiers like that, you're talking, they don't send out the rookies to places like this. Yeah, so you had that, you know, if it was, then we quickly gathered pace then and we were getting ready for Tripoli, you know,
right.
The liberation of Tripoli. Our brigade itself was after growing exponentially. It was after, like, you know, doubling in size. Them fighters were a lot more experienced now and working very well with each other.
Yeah.
Armory was after growing. And
were people happy to see, like, the Libyans, were they happy to see people from other countries coming in to help? Were you welcomed in that way, or was would they be suspicious of people coming in from other places?
No. It'd be the opposite. It would, like, it would be the Gaddafis that would be, you know, Gaddafi loyalists that would be, you know, suspicious of anyone that was coming from abroad, kind of a thing, you know,
right.
Because they reckoned that it was, you know, an international campaign rather than a revolution, like, you know.
I asked Mary Fitzgerald about the young men who participated in the revolutions in Libya and Syria.
A couple of dozen men from Ireland have gone to fight with rebel forces in Syria. Many of them tend to be Libyans who've lived in Ireland for some time. Some of the Libyans who actually fought in Libya in 2011 went on to fight in Syria after that with rebel forces. And we know that at least four young men have been killed fighting with rebel forces in Syria, one of whom was just 16 years old, a young man from Navan. So this element of the engagement over the last 2 years has caused concern within the wider community here, in that because of the relative youth of the young men going over there, their community leaders here, leaders in the mosques who have tried to discourage others from going to fight in Syria because, as we know, the conflict in Syria has become an incredibly complicated conflict, and it is a very, very dangerous environment over there. The first thing I would say is that no one said this was going to be easy, and anybody who was familiar with the Middle East and familiar with the way that societies in that region had been calcified over decades by dictatorships and police states of the type we saw in Syria, in Egypt, in Tunisia and Libya, expected that after the fall of those dictators, that what would emerge overnight would be a perfectly flowering democracy. It's very, very difficult for these societies in transition. We've seen the struggles that Egypt has been going through. We see the pangs that Libya has been experiencing. Tunisia the same, and of course we see the ongoing uprising against President Bashar al-Assad in Syria.
Noel Cullen from Dublin's Northside fought with the British in Aden in the mid-1960s and told us about his experience of fighting in a Muslim country.
first thing that we noticed that when the aircraft, the doors opened the aircraft, was the heat. Straight away, even before we got out of the seat, we could feel the heat coming into us. Coming off the aircraft, what we did notice, very prominent, was the barbed wire, defence positions, all people dug in and everything like that. Transporters there to take us from there, after getting all our gear and so forth. But certainly very, very, very warm, had to come from the UK. How did we find the people? Very strange. Obviously, they were, we're British soldiers, what we're doing out here and everything like that, you know. So as far as being friendly with them, you never really got the chance. Because bearing in mind, those people out there, if you look at our own country, you know what I mean, they didn't want us there.
Hmm.
Having said that, my knowledge of it out there was that there was nothing out there in Aden. The only thing that was going through Aden was a pipeline. You're on your guard all the time, you're out doing patrols and so forth and that. You come back to camp, bit of rest, back out again. And we went up the upcountry again for a second tour. But a great experience for a young soldier, really. Sadly, you know, we lost a few people in an ambush one night, and we had one of our anti-tank guns blew up as well. A few casualties, some cases not fatal, but we did bury some lads out there, very sad, never returned home. So I left a bit of bitterness with us in that particular case, you know. It's not nice, and it's always saying we're doing this and everything like that. Everything's always at the last resort, because we, on foot patrols and stuff like that, we had orders when to shoot, when not to shoot. You know what I mean? You gave the warnings and everything like that. But if a grenade is thrown at you, you've no time to warn anyone, you know. You just have to protect your men, you know, so forth and everything like that, and handle the situation as you see it.
George Kirwan served with the Irish Army in Cairo in the early 1970s. He tells us what he learned about Muslim culture.
I was serving in Cairo. My previous UN mission was very different. It was in Cyprus in 65, but then I headed out to Cairo in 1970 as an observer on the Suez Canal, but based in Cairo itself.
Mm-hmm.
Very different going out to a total Muslim country, but you were never that conscious of the religious difference. At that time, you take 1970.
Yeah.
And for me arriving from Ireland into Egypt, and as a young army man, and you went out to the outpost and you had to cook for yourself and so on in these outposts, but it was a whole new experience.
Mm.
And what was wonderful is this, we had people out there who were young Irish children, and of course they picked up the local language very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot of the local Egyptian language from Irish children.
Okay.
The phraseology and the pronunciation, because it just came second nature to them.
And when you were there, did you see much military action? Were you involved in much military action itself?
Well, we were observers on the Suez Canal.
Mm.
So you have the conflict between the two sides, and you were literally sitting on the front line.
Mm.
In fact, on that very point, I remember one occasion come to mind when the Israeli Air Force was bombing our location with high explosive bombs and napalm, and I was getting very, very, very close. And the Egyptian officer on the outpost of me says, "Sir, please," he said, "I'm praying to my God, will you pray to yours as well?" So, but I remember one occasion like that, all the factors were there. There were troops too close to us from the Egyptian forces. It was a full moon that night, and I said, this could be serious. I remember going up onto the rooftop to check the location, and my radio operator up there, he was a New Zealander, and he had flip-flops on him, and I said, "Ken, take off the flip-flops, put on runners, because if you have to get off that roof tonight, if anything starts, you want to be able to get down those steps through glass and bits and pieces fast." And he eventually agreed to put on proper runners on him. And that evening, in came the Israeli forces, and they hammered the bejeepers out of the area. And he was very happy afterwards that he had the runners on him. And that there was another fellow. Then when I got down into the shelter, I heard a tapping on a door, and I opened it. A fellow fell in. He was an Armenian chap, and he had normally long hair. It was standing on end on his hair because he got that big a fright.
Noel Cullen reflected on whether he's any regrets about serving there.
You've sad regrets, but you're a soldier, you know, you've got to go out there and do your duty. And I know the old teachers, people say it's either demo or something like that. It's not always like that.
Yeah.
I don't think so anyway. It's not always like that. And the last thing you want to do is fire your weapon.
George Kirwan gave his view on how education can assist integration into Irish society.
Very important that Muslims are seen to integrate here.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people have all sorts of strange ideas about Muslims, and people genuinely would feel threatened in a way because so much has happened. I mean, atrocities around the world, fundamentalist Muslims are at the back of it.
Mm.
and then you judge all by the terrible deeds of the few. Mm. And that has to be righted. And you can only do that by education, mm-hmm. at every level.
Mm-hmm.
Because integration and respect for your fellow man, that's what this is all about. There is a need for schools, colleges and so on, to learn about Islam in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Ignorance can be a threat. It can be a fear factor. So we should learn more about their religion and what it's about and what its background and so on. I mean, they see Jesus Christ as a prophet, as was Muhammad.
Mm.
And we have a lot in common between the Bible and early Christianity and Islam.
Dr. Hamroush told me about the aftermath of the Libyan revolution and the stark problems she faced.
Starting from scratch with post-war problems.
Okay.
So there was not just... anything even that was built was destroyed. I wouldn't say everything, but there was so much destruction. People's morals were low. There were so many with post-traumatic stress disorder, depression. There were so many who needed to be treated, and the hospitals were not providing the right services because of lack of many things. A lot of looting happened. Even in the hospitals, a lot of nurses have left the country. They were foreign nurses. The maintenance was... actually, when I came... maintenance was off in all the hospitals for instruments, MRIs, CTs. Many of them weren't working. And the reason was because there were no payment to the companies to do the maintenance. It's because of my previous work as an opposition member.
Hmm.
And also my clean past.
Hmm.
I never worked with the government. Of course, I was a doctor working there, but never for the government. I was just... and so there was... I was a good candidate for that period. And I accepted it as a call for duty. I keep repeating this, but it wasn't really for the glory of being a minister. Actually, there was no glory at all. It was really... the only thing that I didn't have is the gun in my hand. It was hard. It was really like being in the front lines. I was... there were people around me with guns in their hands. But for me, it was really going for a tough job. It wasn't for rest or luxury. And truly, as I expected, that's what the case was. I was working from 7 in the morning till 2 in the morning next. Even my food was on my desk. You go to a system where there is nothing known. In fact, when I came, I didn't find the heads of the administrations, the original ones, they were second line. They're people who were working for them, so they didn't know much about what was going on. There were so many angry people around because the work is not being done. In fact, there were also people who were working against us, so it was a mix of this and that, and everybody had a gun. So that was the whole... you know, on top of that, there were a lot of war-wounded people who were seeking treatment, and they didn't have anywhere to go. It was a great time, with all the pain that came with it. Yeah. It was a great time.
We return to the Al-Said family in Drogheda. In this final piece of the episode, we are joined by Hadifa's mother, Asma Radi, and one of his brothers, Yusuf. They told me about their feelings and expectations for the post-Mubarak regime under President Morsi.
So... we thought that the Mubarak is out, so the revolution succeed. It was a big mistake and wrong, because the deep-rooted regime was in everything.
People were so impatient for more change. Nobody really in the political picture was ready to take that position.
Mm-hmm.
But he took it, and he tried his best. But people were very impatient. They want things to change in a day and night. They wanted, mm-hmm. you know, all the corruption to disappear, which... these were corruptions that were built over years and years, so it was going to take time to fix it. And he did improve a lot of things despite all the factors that were happening around him. The old regime were still there. Just because Mubarak was gone, he was only the head of the pyramid of a very deep infrastructure in the country.
I see my life as being about these three things: searching for truth, defending the weak against injustice and oppressor, and helping to build peace in the world.
They talked to me about Hudaifa, why he went to Syria, and the kind of son, brother, and man he was.
Growing up, he was very quiet, you know. He wasn't exactly he didn't have these goals all his life. This change happened about 3 years before he left. He changed himself completely. He wasn't really into reading. I remember when we were kids, I was the one into the reading. I was the one he'd come to, he was like, you read stories to me because I don't like reading.
He was very creative. He likes to do things, fix things. We do encourage him doing that. And this is what makes us think that he will be kind of engineer or something. We give him all the facilities. And when he grown up, he likes to fix things and solve the problems. So we depend on him even in the material things in the house. Any problem, we do believe that Hudaifa will do it.
People used to feel comfortable telling him their problems. Like, the way he approached people made people comfortable with him.
Uh-huh.
So people just like felt comfortable telling them their problems, that he might be able to help them.
He didn't really plan it, to be honest. What he did is he was going for an activity in Turkey. There was a youth kind of conference that he went and joined. And from there, then he, because that was near kind of the border, so he heard a lot about the refugee camps and what they were like. So he wanted to go and visit them. And so he did. And when he went there, he saw that there is a lot that he can do. So he started helping out and he started kind of starting his own sessions there, education sessions, because there was these camps, there was a lot of kids out of school, you know, their life had stopped. So he started helping out in these camps and started, you know, giving them some sessions and life coaching or speed reading or try to help in whatever way he can. And that's when he kind of told us, you know, I want to stay a bit longer. I feel I can do something here. And he crossed the border with some people that he knew from when he was there in the camps and started helping out in there. Again, more kind of leadership courses and so on. He met with some of the people from the kind of the opposition against Bashar. And he was very, very helpful to them in the way of engineering and the way of his kind of both of his skills came together, because with his engineering skills, he was able to help them. And with his leadership courses, he was able to give them sessions. And, you know, how he got killed at the end is that they were ambushed. They were grouped together and they were ambushed at one of the checkpoints. And one of his friends got shot. Everybody, they were given the order, like, you know, flee, because they're going to, you know, we were surrounded, they're going to get us. So everybody fled, but he refused to leave his friend. So he went back to try to get his friend, but at the end they both got shot and both died.
And from there, he took a permission from me and his mother. And he was very obedient. What if we said no, he want to go, but we did feel that he going for a great cause. And we raise our children to do for others.
They finished by telling me about how even the simple things can resurrect the emotions of having lost someone so dear.
The people, he has his telephone, I stopped his telephone and they keep sending letters. I said to them, he is not here anymore. And they don't know, we need a written letter from him. It's just stupid things. I said to him, I don't have a death certificate for him. And I can't give you that. And they keep sending. To find the letter coming in his name every month or so with €6 credit for him. I said to him, he died. I don't want this credit. I don't close his account. They said, no, we can't. He has to write to us. I said to him, he's dead. He said, he has to write to us. I can understand how do they think.
This series was produced and researched by Peter Carney. It was edited by Peter Carney and Alan Weldon. I'd like to thank everybody who took part in the making of this series. In particular, I'd like to thank all those who gave me their time and shared their experience. I hope the experience they shared has taken you a step closer to understanding Irish Muslims.